Hello and welcome to the Unbundled Attorney Mastermind Podcast. My name is Dave Ahrens and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Unbundled Attorney. In this podcast, we interview many of our provider attorneys, as well as some of the leading experts in the industry to isolate the best practices for building internet-generated leads and how to ethically and effectively offer unbundled legal services and other more affordable options in your practice. For more information about our services, visit www.unbundledattorney.com. All right, this was a great episode with Kathy Orr, who's one of our provider attorneys out of San Antonio, Texas. And we do cover a lot. One of the things that's really unique about Kathy is she didn't begin the practice of law until her 40s when she graduated, and has basically right out of law school started her own solo practice and has done so for the last 15 years, running a solo practice right out of law school. And she talks about that transition and some of the things that helped her make that transition in those early days. We talk about a lot of other things as well, such as how important it is to have an assistant in her practice, some of the things that her assistant does, how it helps her to increase her effective hourly rate when she is offering flat rate unbundled services by leveraging her time and having her assistant help her with some of the drafting, and also how she's been using document automation software. She talks about ProDocs, in Texas, being a software that she uses to get these documents out the door so much faster and more streamlined. We also talk about the payment options she offers. I mean, she works with clients for as low as $100 a month, and she shares the economics of how that's worked out very, very well for her and her ability to work with more clients and increase her monthly cash flow. So it's a very wide-ranging episode, a lot of great takeaways here. So let's get right into it. This interview with Kathy Orr, one of our provider attorneys out of San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, happy that we're getting a chance to talk today and catch up after these many months of working together. And from what I've heard, it's been a wild ride and a very successful one thus far as well.
Yes, it has. I'm glad I found you, or y'all found me, whichever way it worked.
Yeah, so I appreciate you jumping on today to share what that journey has looked like for you and talk a little bit about how you've been able to achieve such results in such a short period of time. So before we jump into some of those specifics, maybe you could talk just briefly about your background, how you got your start in the practice of law, and the regions you serve and the focus area of your practice.
Okay. The focus of my practice is primarily family law, which is what I intended it to be when I went to law school, because I kind of had an unusual path toward the law, because I graduated from, I'm an older, is that okay to say, an older woman, and
yes.
I at midlife, due to some bumps in my own personal road that involved legal issues, I decided to go to law school. So I was in my 40s when I went to law school.
Uh-huh.
And those bumps in the road mostly involved family law issues. And I kept seeing how my case was being handled. And I think my attorney was competent, but he wasn't really meeting my needs. Legally,
right.
He did a competent job, but I needed more than that. And I said, I can do this better than he's doing it, and I can be more compassionate than he's being, having gone through these experiences, and I went to law school. I had a really successful law school career, and I noticed when I was in law school that it was not unusual for the older students to actually outperform academically the younger students, because you seem more dedicated somehow or another. And
you're there because you really, really wanted to be an attorney. Not to say the younger attorneys don't, but maybe their motivations aren't because of the influence of their family or because of their parents went to law school or something like that. But it's truly, I mean, when you're going to law school in your 40s, for you, it was because you just really wanted, you were very clear that you wanted to be an attorney.
Yes. So I actually graduated magna cum laude.
And, oh, nice.
So that was nice. And then I discovered that being a female, middle-aged, even with a magna cum laude law degree, nobody wanted me. And I wanted to do family law anyway, which is predominantly small firm solos. I mean, there are some larger firms that do family law, but they're the great minority. So yep. I said, I'm just going to do this on my own. And I strove out and have been doing it that way since I graduated law school and got my license in 2001.
So you started as a solo practitioner right out of law school?
Yes. I did have the benefit at that time of having worked in the law school's legal clinic for about a year by then. So I had actually already been appearing in court. I'd even handled a trial. Now, I had my supervising attorney there with me, but I did everything. So I had some practical experience because of the clinic that I worked in. And my first office was in another attorney had purchased an old house and converted it to offices. So it was very small. And that attorney also, in some ways, served as a mentor. Hmm. Was willing to help the newbies coming in.
Right.
So I did try a partnership for a while, which was unsuccessful. And that was a couple of years. And I've been solo, so 15 years I've been practicing, and almost all of that's been solo.
Yeah, and for attorneys that, you know, it seems like there's a lot more lawyers that are taking or considering or and have been making the jump straight from law school into becoming a new solo. I'm not, you know, either because of the unavailability of jobs, as it was your experience, or because of, you know, the availability of the internet and being able to market one's practice individually a lot more sufficiently, perhaps. For you, looking back on that experience and having to make that jump, for other attorneys that either have considered making the jump to running their own solo practice out of law school or from a firm, you know, shortly out of law school, was there anything that you found in that transition that, you know, was particularly useful for you to be able to make that transition? You mentioned you had a mentor, an attorney that you worked with in the office that was able to guide you in those initial steps. You mentioned that you worked at the clinics. Is there anything, you know, whether it be those things or anything else that you found was particularly useful for you to make that smooth transition from into starting your own practice?
You got to keep overhead low, 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 because you're not going to start off with a load of clients. And you've got to keep your expectations of the type of clients you're going to get. You're not going to start off getting the $10,000 divorce. So you've got to keep your expectations reasonable, your overhead low, and not expect to put much money, if any, in your pocket for a while.
Okay, so let's fast forward here. We believe we got started maybe working together about 5 months ago as of the recording of this episode here. So it's been quite a journey from what I understand. So maybe you can share a little bit about, you know, where you were at when we ended up linking up and started working together, and what this last 5 months has looked like for you as far as a transition, and then we can start to dive into the tactics and the strategies you've developed to experience the results you had, or whatever it is that has developed over these last few months.
Sure. At the time I started taking these cases, frankly, my caseload was too low. I needed more work. I have a very able assistant who has many years of experience in the legal market and working for attorneys and can do a lot of really good things. But she and I were not being worked to our full ability. I had more time on my hands than I wanted. She had more time on her, could have done more work. And she wanted to do more work, so she was very supportive of, let's get these people in, let's go. And so she was actually very supportive of me delving into increasing our workload. So I started getting referrals from y'all and started jumping on the first one I got. And by jumping on them, I mean I was calling those people as soon as I had. Sometimes I was free when I got the email from you. And I would call the people right away. Sometimes I was not free when I get the email to you, but those people got a phone call that evening. So you have to be very conscientious about contacting these people as soon as possible. You know, don't let the water run under the bridge. You got to jump in it while it's nice and juicy.
Yeah, and do you have an idea of, you know, you're serving San Antonio, you know, Bexar County and some of the surrounding counties as well when they have cases in those counties. About roughly how many leads are you been receiving, and do you know how much this has ramped up since you have originally started about 5 months ago, and then we can maybe start talking about, you know, how it is that you've been able to work with these clients in addition to obviously calling them in real time, which is a really core component of fielding internet leads.
You know, I haven't sat here and counted up how many leads I've been getting, and it has recently ratcheted down since y'all have thankfully hired someone else to service this area as well, which I'm happy about, because I was getting really more than I could handle. It was okay at first. I could handle them at first when my existing workload was lower. But as my existing workload due to the leads was ratcheting up, it was becoming more difficult to handle the new leads.
Right.
Because I had less and less time available. So I'm guessing I got probably 20 in the first couple of weeks, maybe 25.
Yeah, I'm just going back here and looking, and it looks like you were getting, you know, at least 30 or 40 a month at least. So, you know, maybe about 10 to 15 new leads a week.
Yes, and that's
just in Bexar County. Yeah.
And for a solo, that was too much for me.
Yes. Yeah, so we ramped things down, but you know, obviously it became too much because so many of the leads that you were talking to ended up hiring you for your service. So you had to, you obviously start delivering the services that they'd hired you for, and then also balance out, you know, how do you field the new leads as well. So how did you find that balance as a solo between, you know, obviously making sure that you're performing the services that the attorney's clients have hired you to do and focusing on those tasks, you know, diligently, while also making sure that you're making time to field the calls from the leads that are from new clients that are requesting your services as well?
That's a good question. And actually, I'll say you can't work 8 to 5 and do it, because as your workload increases due to y'all's leads, you're spending more time at the courthouse. And I can't be working on y'all's leads while I'm at the courthouse servicing somebody.
Right.
Which meant that frequently I have resorted to, in the last few months, most leads get followed up on in the evening hours. And people will frequently be surprised, you know, 8 o'clock at night, they're getting a phone call from me. But if that works, that's what works for me, is those hours when it gets calm and quiet, is that's when I sit down and return phone calls to leads.
And do you find when you call leads in the evening that you're able to, I would assume because a lot of the clients are getting off work, that might actually be a very good time to be able to reach folks, is in those evening hours?
I've had great success in reaching them. I've gotten from you I think that there's only one lead that I can remember that had a bad phone number. Didn't respond to email, had a bad phone number. So, and that's out of all the leads I've gotten, only one that I could not reach because I didn't have any way to get in touch with them except email, and I got no response to an email.
And that's out of about 230 leads so far or so. So for the most part, you've been able to get you know, reach out and connect with most of these folks.
Yes, sir. And I've even had, I think it's becoming more common lately, say the last month or so, that these leads are calling my office before I've had a chance to call them.
Yeah, that's some of the work we've done on the profile page to, you know, make that more prominent and have a very clear call to action to have clients, you know, calling your office right there in the descriptions. And that really helps with giving people instruction on, you know, what they need to do, which is go ahead and call the attorney we've matched up with. So we've been hearing that across the board that that's been really helping with getting more clients to call your office in person, because there's nothing better than, you know, as far as, you know, being able to, you know, have a conversation around serving a client than to have them call you immediately when they submitted the request, when they first decided and took action to reach out to an attorney to get the assistance they need, because they're conscious of what's going on. They're feeling whatever emotion it was that incited them to take that action. And so they're very receptive to hearing your feedback and the guidance you're going to provide for them to help them take that next step.
Okay. So, you know, and of course some of them, I'm not in the office when they call and they get a return phone call that evening. But I think that's good if you're encouraging them to call immediately. Because you can't sit on these leads. If you sit and wait a day or two, they're gone.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're serious about hiring someone if they don't hear from you. So why don't we dive into, so you receive the leads via email. You call them when you can during the day, but if you're not available, you get back to them in the evening. So let's suppose you reached out to them in the evening, you jumped on the phone with the client. What are some of the things that you focus on that initial consultation over the phone to, and what is your kind of next step that you're helping them get to on that initial call?
I would say my main focus, although not my only focus, in first talking to them is giving them an opportunity to basically vent. Tell me what their problem is. So I can see, is there any legal solution to this problem?
Right.
The vast majority of them, there is a legal solution, but not everybody. And so I think it's important that you give the potential client the first impression that you're interested in what they have to say.
And what does that look like for you? Does it mean you kind of let them just talk about whatever they want to talk about for 10 minutes, or do you work, you know, is it a couple minutes and then you start asking questions? What's that? Where do you find that balance between letting them, you know, go off on a tangent or, you know, just talk about whatever they want to talk about and also keeping that conversation focused?
Yes, that conversation frequently needs to be redirected by throwing in a question here and there. Because you're right, they will just go off on tangents. No, I'd say it's considerably more time than a couple of minutes, and sometimes more time than 10 minutes.
Right. Okay, so it could be, you know, 10, 20 minutes where you'll just have a conversation around what is they're looking for help with, letting them describe to you the problem that they're having, before you will start to discuss the strategy or basically give them feedback on what it is they need to do and what it's going to take to get that done, just so they feel fully like they've been heard.
Right. I think it's real important to make sure they feel like they're heard.
Yep, absolutely. That's a step one. Okay, so then let's say you've given them a chance to vent, share what it is that they need assistance with. You have some good clarity around the main facts and considerations of their case. What are some of the next steps you go through to qualify the client and then help them take the next step with, whether it be meeting with your office or you're enrolling them at that point, or where do you go from there?
Well, you need to make, in my opinion, some conversation about money, because I don't really want people coming in if they haven't got any. Because
yep.
I'm not going to be able to help. I'm not a pro bono. I'm not working for you for nothing. So if you can't come up with some initial money, I'm not going to want to do your case, and I'm not going to waste time having you coming into my office.
Right.
So you need to have some conversation about money and what their expectations are about money and how much they can come up with.
Would you be able to give some examples of how you'll transition to talking about that? So let's say they say they want to, they told you they want to file for custody. They've given you some reasons why they feel it's in the best interest of their kid to do so. And so you've maybe reflected that back. And then from there, how do you start the discussion of, okay, here's what needs to be done. And then how do you go about determining where they're at financially so that you can then speak to the options you can provide to them based on that?
Well, I usually start off by asking about their job. You can learn a lot from their employment.
Okay.
And you can kind of put this around that you're not being nosy about their money, as you're wanting to know what time would be good to see them in the office, for instance. Do I need to work around your work schedule to set up an office visit? Oh, really? That's interesting. What do you do for a living? You know, so you can get a feel for their financial viability as a client by first finding out about their employment.
Okay.
And then I usually ask them if they've spoken with any other lawyers, did these other lawyers discuss with them a retainer? And a lot of times you'll get a yes, and they'll come up with a figure. Yes, I talked to another lawyer, and they said a retainer of $5,000. Well, I just haven't got it, you know.
That's right.
And then I will lead into, well, I can work with that. I can work with a lower initial payment if you can make monthly payments. Could you do something along those lines? And usually we'll lead into, depending on what their case is, if they're wanting me to file, say, defend them on something, and I'm not going to be spending a lot of money on filing paperwork, I may start as little as $500. But if they're wanting me to file a divorce and serve their spouse, and, you know, I'm not going to start on $500 because it's going to cost me $400 to file the case and serve their spouse.
Right.
So that's just not a realistic goal. So I need to have a feel about what the case is to talk about money as well. Obviously,
okay,
some cases are going to be simple and quick and cheap, and some cases are going to be involved and expensive.
And so on that call, once you've gotten a general idea of where they're at financially and where they can fit, you know, payments in their budget or where is that they can afford, how specific do you get into exactly what you think it's going to cost for them to get it done, or at least what that starting fee is? And do you quote that right over the phone and say, well, this is what we're looking at to get started. Can you fit that in your budget? Or do you say, well, this is going to be a range. This is probably what we're thinking about. We have unbundled. We could also do more of a payment plan. We can get into it. And then do you basically qualify, have them come in, or do you really get into the specifics on here's what I expect it to cost so that they know exactly what they need to bring in for that appointment?
All right. I bill by the hour just like almost every family attorney I've ever met, which means estimating total cost is sometimes an exercise in futility.
Right, of course.
So, you know, you can say, you know, something like what you're talking about may cost more than $5,000, but we will start working with less than that. So you let them know that this ain't going to be cheap, but you can make it work for them financially.
Okay. And you'll give them, you know, maybe a starting point that they can see and hit and work towards, or either that they have right now that you can start working with, or as a starting target that they could fit, you know, if they could fit that in their budget, then you could start working for them?
Yes.
Okay. And so maybe what would be good is if we could start talking about some of the different options and the ways in which you do work with folks that maybe can't afford $5,000 or $3,000 right up front to be able to retain you to get started on their case. What are the types of options that you will typically offer someone that is in that position that maybe only has a few hundred or a thousand or something like that available to get started on a, you know, on a typical family law case?
Okay. That, again, depends on if I'm going to have to be spending very much money filing and serving. Because in Bexar County, where I'm working, you know, it's, let's say we're doing a divorce with kids. That's a little over $300 just to file the case. Same thing for a SAPSR. And I'm assuming you know enough about the law to know what a SAPSR is. If you don't, I'll explain it.
I do to a certain degree. I mean,
a SAPSR, suit affecting the parent-child relationship.
Okay, yes.
Generally speaking, if we've got kids involved, it's going to cost more money, although not always. If, you know, people are being reasonable to reach agreements, it can be less. But, you know, people are not reasonable a lot of times.
Right.
So if I'm going to be filing a new case like that, then I'm going to have to be serving one or two more people on a case. Sometimes I have to serve two people. Then, of course, then they're going to have to come up with enough money not only to give me something, motivation to start working, but to cover those initial out-of-pocket costs. So on those types of cases, the minimum I'm going to start working for is more than if maybe they've already got a divorce filed and they just need it finished up. That's easy and quick.
So can you give a gradient or some examples or specifics, for especially for attorneys that are starting to consider offering these options? And maybe in the past, we're only offering, you know, full representation, $3,000 to $5,000 up front. What can some of those retainer agreements look like, whether it be what the starting fee is, and then how you figure out what works as far for the client on a payment plan basis? How you, you know, and then obviously from what you're saying, it sounds like you have to take into consideration how much it's going to cost to file, what's it going to take to get the case filed, and make sure you have at least that amount paid up front so you can accomplish those initial filings. And then how do you, you know, structure that from there?
Generally speaking, and it varies from case to case, if they're wanting full service, which most people are in a family law case, they don't want to have to do it themselves. I've had some that are do-it-yourselfers, but most people want an attorney to take care of the details because they don't know what those details are and they don't want to have to worry about it. And they're busy taking care of their own lives and their own jobs, and so they don't necessarily have enough time to do a lot of research and figure out what they got to do. And then frequently, even if they do that, they do it wrong. So a lot of people, well, I wouldn't say a lot of people. Some people, you can, if it's really simple matters, you can say, offer an option of, I just do the paperwork and I'll tell you what to do with it. And, you know, here's the process you follow and here's what I'm going to charge you. Just do the paperwork, which is your cheapest option. And then you start explaining what the procedures are going to do. And a lot of those people, suddenly they don't want to do that. They want somebody else doing that for them.
Right.
I lead into, well, we can do that. That's not an issue, but it's going to cost you more money. Oh, well, I'd be willing to pay for it. So you just have to kind of feel them out as to where they want to go.
Okay.
And like I said, there's been some that is not infrequent, especially in Bexar County, where the people getting pro se divorces discover there's this huge long 6-month waiting list to get in and do a proof up on their divorce, which is required by, in Texas, we have to do a very short court proceeding in front of the judge to get the divorce granted. You can't get it granted just on paper. You got to get the client in front of the judge. And an attorney, assuming you've got a case that is not contested, which some of these are, can walk in on certain times of the day because there's an uncontested docket. So the attorneys can just walk the clients in and do it whenever. I can pick a day, Monday through Friday. Which one do you like? You know, that fits with my schedule. But they have to wait these 6 months to get on this uncontested docket, which a lot of people don't like waiting those 6 months. So I get people coming in when they found out that in order to get a court setting on their pro se divorce, it's going to take 6 months.
So that gives them a little extra motivation for them to want to retain you to be able to expedite the process.
Right. So if all I'm going to be doing is drafting up a divorce decree and going to court to prove it up, and I'm located right now just a few blocks from the courthouse, so going down to the courthouse is not a problem, you know, I can probably do that for $500, and I'm making money.
So it takes you maybe, you know, a couple hours to get the documents drafted up and then get it filed at the courthouse?
I have a really good assistant. She's going to be drafting the documents.
How important is it for you, Kathy, you know, especially, you know, when you've been ramping up your practice in the way that you have over these past 4 or 5 months, how important has that assistant been for you to get some of these tasks done, get these documents prepared? And for attorneys that maybe don't have an assistant, what are some of the things that you've had her do that really takes some of the workload off your chest?
I say having her is indispensable. And what does she do? She schedules appointments. She answers the phone. She drafts. She can draft divorce decrees. Now, I'm going to go through there and make changes in them, and she's going to fix them after I make changes. So no document leaves my office that I haven't personally okayed and frequently made changes to. But if she can sit down and draft up this divorce decree, and she can do it as fast as I could do it, so she can sit down and do it in a couple of hours, that, of course, is lots less expensive than me spending 2 hours of attorney time drafting it up.
Right.
So, you know, it takes me 10 or 15 minutes to go through it and make changes, or to okay it, which sometimes happens, but frequently it's changes. So having her has made all the difference in the world, because I can't substitute her for doing things like going to court. She can,
right.
You know, clients that call in and have a question, most of those, or at least a lot of them, she can handle herself instead of having me to use my time to do that. So she does a lot of client contact, and that saves me a lot of time too. So you got to pay somebody to do it, but if it's not worth attorney time to do all those tasks.
Yeah, absolutely. And have you experimented with having your assistant do lead calls when you're in court to touch base with clients and set appointments for later on in the afternoon? And if so, what does that look like, and to what degree has she been involved in that?
The only degree she's been involved in that is now more recently, that people are calling me instead of waiting for me to call them. She's the one here answering the phone. So, but generally speaking, you know, they want to talk to the attorney. They don't want to talk to the assistant. So she's not making the initial calls to them when we're making initial contact, at least not yet.
Right. And when you do the document service option, for example, which you said around 500, and you have your assistant do the drafting and then you review it and so forth, do you charge that as a flat rate, or is it a representation of your hourly rate? So you think, do you say, okay, well, I only need to spend 30 minutes and it's going to be that, and so I just bill for 30 minutes of my time? Or do you just charge a flat rate, say 500, and even though it only takes maybe 30 minutes of your time, an hour or two of hers, which is at a different billable hourly rate, is it still a flat rate, so your effective hourly rate is still very, very good.
Usually I do those on a flat rate, and that how much I charge them depends on what documents they want and how many documents they want.
Right. Well, we've heard from a lot of attorneys, though, and it's interesting that you do the flat rate, is that, you know, for the client, that especially one that just got quoted $3,000 or $5,000 from another attorney, being able to have an attorney draft up all their paperwork for them, make sure all the I's are dotted, T's are crossed, and everything's done properly according to the rules of the court in that local jurisdiction, you know, for $500 or $750, even if it's on a flat rate, is a great value. But the question is, you know, if your hourly rate is, say, $250 an hour, does it have to take you 2 hours in order to get that done? Well, you know, if you can leverage the time of your assistant to do, you know, maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours of that time, and then you only have to spend 15, 20 minutes with the client on the front end, maybe review 15 minutes on the back end, you know, it took you maybe 30 minutes of your time to deliver that $500 product, and maybe, you know, $25 an hour, 2 hours of time with your assistant, but your effective hourly rate can still be very, very good when you're offering these types of flat rate model and you're also leveraging the time of your assistant. Has that helped for you to see a very good effective hourly rate because of the fact that you've been doing that on a flat rate?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more?
Sweet and short answer, but I'm assuming you want me to say more. You know, they don't know how much time these documents take. And a divorce decree with kids may be 50 pages long, so they get real impressed, even though a large portion of that is done through computer software. I'm not sitting down and writing all 50 pages of that. There are, at least in Texas, I don't know what other states do, but in Texas, we have what's called a family law practice manual, which has approved forms in it for family law cases approved by the State Bar of Texas. And some smart guy named Schoolcraft a number of years ago started a company called ProDoc, which he has sold out to Thompson West. Somebody's made a ton of money off this program because almost every family lawyer uses it. And it uses the language straight out of the Family Law Practice Manual, which is the language that the State Bar tells us to use. So this program works by answer questions that individualize the document for each client. So by the time it comes out of the program, you've got a 90%, 95% complete document that you just may need to, in some places, personalize some more.
Yep.
So by utilizing that software and then someone else putting it through the software, she's not coming up with all this language. The software is coming up with all the language. She's just answering the questions, which we have on our intake form. So by the time you coordinate using your intake form and using this software, the document preparation is streamlined.
Exactly. Yeah, this has been a very common thread in many of our podcast episodes and throughout the network, is attorneys utilizing these types of document automation technology and document preparation softwares to start to, like you said, streamline the process and lower the amount of time it takes for you and your and or, in your case, your staff, your assistant, to be able to get these documents prepared and back to you for review and into the hands of the client, so that, you know, when you offer these flat rates, the faster you can prepare the case and the documents, if you're doing it at a flat rate, the higher your effective hourly rate and the higher your margin. So by implementing these technologies, it, you know, it sounds like that's really made a big difference in your ability to get these done, get the tasks done quickly and efficiently, which, you know, allows you to make a much higher hourly rate when you're working on a flat rate unbundled.
Yes, and of course the software's not free. You got it. And the computers that are running the software are not free. So, and the person running the computer that's running the software is not free. So there's still costs involved in addition to the time, but it's lower than the addition of more man hours or woman hours, as the case may be.
Exactly. Yep. Okay, so that's a great example, and I appreciate you going into a little bit more depth about those that flat rate document service option. Let's say, for example, that they really do want to, you know, have an attorney handling the case from start to finish, but again, you know, don't have the $5,000 up front. Can you share a little bit more about in detail about the types of payment options you have offered, and, you know, what that typically looks like for clients, and how you figure out what that payment plan is going to look like by, you know, I'm sure by asking them questions and so forth, but, you know, how do you figure out what that balance is going to be, and of course, you know, depending on what needs to be done?
Well, before I was doing unbundled, I had, and it was basically in my head, you know, after talking with the client, I'd quote a retainer amount, usually about, you know, depending on what the case was, in the neighborhood of $1,500 to $2,500. Sometimes higher, sometimes lower, but mostly in that neighborhood. So I kind of have use that as a basis for putting in my contracts with these people. They're paying a retainer of that amount, but they're paying it in this manner. So they're paying it, number one, to get me started working on the case. They're paying me a certain amount at the time they sign the contract. Although there have been a few people who want me to agree to take payment. I tell them, I won't start working on your case until you've paid this much, for instance. And right. They say, okay, well, what if I just pay you as I get the money? And then can you start working on the case when you get that balance? I say, sure. So I've even had some people that are paying money, and I haven't started working on their case. And I'm not going to start working on their case until they reach that minimum balance.
Has that been helpful for some clients to know that they're putting money aside? Because a lot of clients will, you know, attorneys will just say, okay, well, look, you know, we need a minimum of 500, a minimum of 1,000 or 1,500, whatever it is, to get started on your case. Give us a call once you have it. And they just turn that client away. Whereas it sounds like, you know, in certain circumstances, you might say, well, if you don't have that right now, they can just start making payments towards it. And then once they have it, then you just take action. But at that point, you're getting them started working towards, you know, making payments towards their balance. Has that really helped them with their commitment in taking that first step, even if it's only $100 or a couple hundred dollars or whatever they can afford towards, you know, paying that balance off?
I think it has. And it makes them feel more secure because they know they've got somebody lined up to do the work. So it's kind of like somebody's put you in layaway.
Right.
You know, they go to the store and they pick out what they want, but they don't get to take it home until they pay for it. So they're more motivated to make those payments to get you to start working. So that has worked in some instances where they can't even come up with, you know, $500 to get me started.
Hmm. And so what's an example of a payment? Would you take $100, $200, $250? Is there a minimum? Or do they just kind of, you know, do they take a credit card payment every week or so and that just goes into the trust account? How does that work? What's been the logistics of making those payments, you know, collecting those payments from the clients up to that threshold and when you can actually file for them?
Okay. It goes into the trust account, of course, because you may have to refund if you don't ever do anything on their case but collect payments for a while.
Of course, yeah.
But I haven't had one so far that has not gotten me the minimum amount before I started working on the case.
Wow, that's great to hear. Okay.
And at that point, if they're just wanting to start making some payments, I don't put them on a schedule. I say, when you want to make a payment, you call. And you tell me how much you want to pay, and that'll go towards your case. And the more you pay and the more frequently you pay, the quicker we'll get to working on your case.
Okay.
So I don't at that point you have to pay a certain amount every so often. After they've signed a contract and I'm making them sign a contract too, but it's going to specify that until we've received that minimum balance, we're not going to start working on their case.
Okay.
But once that minimum balance is reached, then they need to be on a regular payment schedule.
Okay.
And what I am doing mostly is you pay once a month. If you want to pay more often than that, we can certainly do that. But you need to pay at least $100 once a month. And this is going to, if you only pay $100, you're probably going to be paying for a really long time. So if you'd like to pay more than that, if you can afford to pay more than that, it would be better for you. Because we're going to get this paid off a lot quicker. So I have people paying various amounts. The least I'll do is $100 a month. And they need to give me a credit card and an authorization to just automatically charge their credit card on a certain day each month.
Okay. And then do you use like a LawPay or automated payment solution, payment processing solution to make that payment automatically? Or do you just, you know, at the end, at a specific time each month, you guys just do all the payments and so forth?
Well, we're doing it in-house right now, and Graham keeps telling me I need to start using LawPay.
Yeah, we've certainly had a lot of lawyers using that as a platform because it just takes away the administrative component of having to remember to make that charge. And it also, you know, you can time it so that when people are getting paid, you know, on that date is the date that the payment's coming out. So it increases the amount of times that payment's going to go good. But certainly, you know, you can also do it manually as well. It works just as fine. It just takes, you know, you just have to do it. You know, you have to schedule it.
Well, we just set up a calendar that has listed on it who's paying when.
Yep, exactly.
So every morning my assistant checks the calendar and I charge so-and-so today. And she runs the credit card.
Right. Okay, so, you know, you mentioned $100 a month. I would have to think that a lot of attorneys would think, wow, I mean, that's such a small amount for a client to be paying for you to be representing them on a case. Do you get into a situation where you've provided a lot more services than the $100 that they paid, where you're getting behind, the clients are getting behind on paying you for your services? And has that become a challenge for you to collect on or and do some clients, you know, fall, you know, pretty far behind or don't end up making those payments? Have you had any of those kinds of challenges, and is it consistent or not?
I've had pretty good luck with consistent payments. There have been a couple, one of whom I'm still representing, who are behind in their payments. But, you know, if they call in and they explain to me what the problem is, you know, maybe I'll give them a break for a month or two. I just want them to notify me before, if it gets too bad, I'm going to withdraw. As to do people go upside down, absolutely. Because a lot of the work of a family law case is done at the very beginning, especially if they want a temporary orders hearing, which is the quickest I can get them into court to get some relief about kids, which is a couple of weeks after I file the case. So if I'm going and maybe spending at least half a day or maybe all day in court, a couple of weeks after I filed this case, I go upside down, you know, right away.
And was that kind of a leap of faith for you? I don't know if you've always offered these payment plans, or maybe you just started. I think you mentioned you used to do the full retainer before Unbundled, then you started offering these payment plans. Was that a bit of a leap of faith for you to start offering such, you know, flexible payment plans as low as $100 a month when you knew that you'd be providing more work than you'd be getting paid for, at least on the very front end?
Yes. And
how has that worked for you?
Yeah. So far it's worked well, which is why I've been building up a base of about $3,000 now. And it's in gradually increasing base of payments that I'm receiving every month.
Yeah, and this was something that was mentioned on the previous episode. We have, you know, attorneys that were scaling up their practice in Oklahoma, and they talked about how good it feels to know. I mean, they had about, you know, $6,000 or whatever it was that they had in monthly cash flow coming in every single month, and how comforting it was for them to know that their bills were paid, their overhead was covered, because that money was coming in every single month no matter what. How helpful has that been, or how comforting has that been for your practice, knowing that you have that steady cash flow that's there every single month to cover some of your expenses?
I think it's really been helpful. And of course, every case doesn't need attention every month. So I'm still getting that little bit of cash flow from cases that are sitting, say, in my file because they have to wait for the next thing to occur before we can do anything. There's certain deadlines, and maybe if their next deadline is not coming up, you know, I've got to wait. So, you know, there may be a file you're getting paid on that $100 or $200 that you haven't even looked at that case that month.
Right. You know, and you also mentioned before that you won't file the case until they have a minimum amount covered, which covers the filing and your time to get the documents in order and get things prepared. And so you've kind of covered yourself on the front end there. And then a lot of these cases, like you said, have time frames where you may not have to work on the case for 2-3 months, depending on the waiting times of the court. What percentage would you say of the clients that you go on payment plans, are you lockstep with what they paid you versus what you provide as service, versus clients that have fallen behind because you've had to provide more service than they paid for up to that point?
I haven't really sat down and analyzed those figures, but I'd say I'm probably have more clients that are owing me money.
Uh-huh. More than not, yeah?
Yeah.
And from the...
But I'm good with that as long as I finish their case and they keep paying me.
Yeah. And from the last few months, you know, 6 months or so that we've been working together, that they've been pretty consistent about making those payments, even when they're done with the case. Have you had some clients that you've been done with the case that continue paying you from there?
Well, since I haven't been doing this but a few months, I haven't had a lot of those. But I've got a couple of those, and they're still paying.
You know, we've heard the exact same feedback from just so many other attorneys in the network. And I think that, again, like you... You know, we talked about it. It is a bit of a leap of faith, and there's a certain degree of trust you have to have for, you know, to offer those options. But from what we've heard, overwhelmingly, like you said, there's 1 or 2 out of 50, you know, maybe 2-3% most that won't make those payments. But, you know, when you start to think about the amount of folks that you're now opening the door to be able to offer these options, offer services to them that otherwise couldn't afford it, and the amount of additional revenue that brings in as a result, you know, it seems to be it more than offsets the, you know, couple clients here and there that may not be up to date or may not make those payments with that increase in revenue. Have you found that it really just balances out that way for you?
Yes, it does. And I think that you get, because you're offering these clients options that they didn't know were available, that they're really grateful that they have found somebody that will work with them on a way that they can afford, and therefore are more compliant in paying it because they are just think, what a prize. I found somebody who can work with me.
Right. Yeah. And how important has that been for you in being able to provide that access to clients in the way that you do by offering these options?
To me personally or to the client?
Or to you personally.
Well, of course, it's opened up my workload. It's increased my workload, which is, I'm a workaholic, so I like that. And it has given me a greater sense of satisfaction, maybe is the right word, that I'm helping more people. And seeing, even in cases where you do not get the result that these people are wanting when they first walk in your door, most of them are grateful that you're working for them, you know.
Yep.
And so that makes me feel good.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because at the end of the day, I mean, when you're able to make that difference for those many people and you're getting that appreciation, I mean, it's, you know, attorneys go to school for a lot of reasons, but, you know, most attorneys, I would assume, go to school because they want to help people. They want to make the difference. They want to, you know, level the justice and help people get through the process and get custody. So, you know, that's really what it comes down to is, you know, how you are able to serve those in your community. And it sounds like by offering these options, it's been, you know, a real godsend for some of the folks that you've been helping.
I think so, and I think they show their, I get lots of hugs and thank yous, and that means a lot. At least it does to me. Now, there may be other people who, you know, having a bigger paycheck or a bigger office or a fancier chair might be more important, but to me, the sense of helping people and them appreciating it is more important. I know I need to have money coming in. I know I need to be, you know, my office costs money to run. Those have to be met. So there's got to be money involved. But the sense of appreciation is very important to me.
Yeah. And from a business standpoint, if we look at it from strictly a business standpoint, the money is there. I mean, these are clients that you would otherwise be turning away. And now you have $3,000 a month in monthly cash flow that you otherwise wouldn't have if you weren't offering these options. So, you know, there's, I think, a major assumption that if you, you know, work with lower income families, you have to make a low income. And, you know, from what we've heard from most of our attorneys offering these options, that just really isn't the case. It actually makes great financial sense because it gives you the capacity to serve 2, 3, 4, 5 times as many clients as most any other firm would that doesn't offer these options.
Well, I'm not offering them cheap legal services. I'm just offering them more reasonable payment alternatives.
Exactly, right. It's not about cheap or low quality. It's just about adapting the payment options and the solutions that you're providing to them, whether it be the unbundled fixed fee option or the payment plan solutions such that people can actually afford to fit in their budget.
Yes. You know, people don't go into a car dealership, or at least not very many people go into a car dealership with $30,000 in their pocket to buy a car. That's why there's car financing, right? And
yep.
It's just not something that is been widely done in the legal profession. Lawyers want the people coming in with the $10,000 in their pocket, and that's just not realistic for many people. Doesn't mean they're not willing to necessarily pay the $10,000 to get their work done, but they're not able to pay it when they walk in your door.
That's right.
So it,
and there are, yeah, go ahead.
So it gives you the opportunity to help these people and still get paid.
Exactly.
People that would be walking away with no help and just living in bad situations.
Yep, exactly. And like you said, you know, some of these clients, they may end up paying the $10,000 just because of what's involved and the amount of time it's involved and, you know, what it's going to take to get their case to fruition. But they're just not going to have the full amount up front. They'll just get there over time by offering these flexible payment options. And so the money's still there. You just may need to structure a little differently so that that person can continue to fit in their budget over time.
Yes. And once you start building up that downline to where you have more and more people that are making the monthly payments, it becomes easier and easier for you to still maintain your standard of living and maintain your law office.
Yep, exactly. Okay, great. Well, this has been really helpful, Kathy, to shine a light on some of these options you've been offering. We've been just been getting some great feedback from the clients on how grateful they are to be able to work with you and have you be able to help them in such an affordable manner, and certainly couldn't be more pleased about the results it's brought from you financially to be able to be offering the folks these options and helping you grow your practice and increase your revenue and so forth. Before we maybe wrap up, is there anything else that, you know, you found over these, you know, the course of these last 5 months in filling these leads that you've had to adapt or adjust or have found to be particularly effective either in, you know, getting clients to come in the office or, you know, mistakes you might have made that you've changed that has made a difference for you in your experience over these past few months as we wrap up.
Yeah, I've had a problem with people that set up appointments and don't show up. So for a while, I was using Graham's suggestion that we charge them $50 to set up an appointment. And if they come in and they don't hire you for anything, they get their $50 back. Well, nobody was getting their $50 back. They were spending it with me for something. And lately, I have not been as rigid about that, and I need to go back to it. Because you get appointments set up, and you make sure you're there, and then they don't show up. So some of the unbundled leads have, you need to get them some more motivation, get them their finances on the line at least a little bit to come in your door.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And did you find that when you started collecting that, you know, $50 deposit, that was making a difference in the amount of how often they would show up for that appointment?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and were you taking that? Were you charging that payment when you collected it right away, or were you, or was it a deposit? Like, were you taking the credit card and only charging if they didn't show up?
No, we took the credit card and charged it.
Okay.
And then, did you get a? Then yeah, if they retained me for something, I gave them credit for that $50. All right, I keep your $50, but I give you credit for it to whatever I'm charging you. If you don't show up, I keep your $50, and if you show up and don't retain me for anything, I'm going to return your $50. I bet I return $50 one time.
Right, exactly. You know, it's such a risk-free offer. You know, like you can come in, you make this deposit, $50. You know, it's just if anyone's really serious and wants to invest in their case, $50 is not going to break the bank for even folks that are, you know, are limited means. I mean, that's very reasonable. And, you know, if you come in and for whatever reason you don't feel like, you know, what we're going to provide for you as services is a match for what you're looking for.
Or maybe we're not the right fit.
Or maybe, you know, you didn't like the fact that I went to this law school, or maybe you're from whoever, whatever. It could be anything. They're not, you know, they're going to get the $50 back. So it seems like it's a fair enough offer to put somebody on the line to be able to come in and value your time. And at the same time, you know, it's very low risk for them because even if it doesn't work out, they're not putting that money on the line.
Right. And there's going to be some people that come in, and I've had some people come in and not hire me and tell me to keep the $50 anyway.
Yep.
But
yeah.
But it works really well, and I need to start doing it faithfully again, which I have not been recently, but I need to start doing that faithfully.
Yeah. And one thing I'll suggest, just while we're on the topic, Tara Lee in one of her recent podcast episodes called Proven Sales Strategies to Convert More Leads and Eliminate No-Shows, shared that he used to take a $50 or maybe it was $100 payment to secure the appointment and would refund it if they didn't show up. But he would get a little bit of pushback sometimes. People saying, "Oh, I want to think about it," or, you know, "Well, I thought this was going to be a free consultation," or whatever it was. But they'll get a little bit of pushback when the client, you know, had to make a payment right then and there. You know, like they knew that they was going to get charged. And so what he actually found was, just by saying, "Hey, look, you know, what we're going to do is take a credit card to secure the appointment, and only if you don't show up, we're going to charge you $50. But as long as you show up for the appointment, we're not going to charge you at all." He found that he was able to get the exact same result as far as eliminating the no-shows just by taking the credit card and not charging it, as he was by charging the card right off the bat. And so it was an interesting experiment to hear that feedback. And then by offering it that way, it basically eliminated any resistance or objections he was getting from the client on, you know, having to get that card over the phone and charging it if he wasn't charging it unless they didn't show up.
That might be I might consider that.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the end result is, okay, we're doing this to get them to show up for the appointment, but the lowest resistance possible in order to still accomplish that same result, that same outcome, with minimizing the amount of folks that are going to have, you know, resistance or objections to doing so, it seems like that it can accomplish the same thing while minimizing the amount of, you know, any level of pushback or so forth. And I don't think there's anything wrong with charging $50 off the phone. We have tons of lawyers that do that as well. But it's interesting to experiment with these two ways of approaching it and see if we can still end up with the same result without having to have the card charged right off the bat. So if you haven't heard that episode yet with Tara Lee, you might find it interesting because he specifically explains and shares exactly how he frames that and shares that with the client and the impact that's had on his practice from relative to the way he'd used to do it before.
That might be a good idea. I may try that.
Yep. All right. So with that, you know, again, Kathy, I appreciate you coming on and sharing and taking the time to share with us, you know, the tactics and the way in which you've been working with the clients. You know, it feels really great to hear how much fulfillment you've gotten out of, you know, offering these options. We really appreciate the fact that you've been so flexible and so accommodating with people's ability to pay. I mean, this is what it's really all about. You know, we've got 70% of Americans filing pro se, and it's not just because the forms are available online. It's because they can't afford $3,000 to $5,000, and that's 2/3 of our market now. And so by offering these options, you're really, you know, helping to improve the accessibility and affordability of legal services, you know, in your local area of Texas and collectively all throughout the United States. And by sharing these options, you know, I'm sure a lot of attorneys will benefit by, you know, taking good notes and starting to offer some of these options in their practice, even in ways they hadn't considered before. So I just thank you again for taking the time and sharing so openly about how you've been able to work with clients in this way.
Well, you know, limiting the pro ses, of course, you know, attorneys say, well, that takes away our money. But really what it does by helping to offer some options that are affordable to lower the pro ses is it the judges don't like dealing with these pro ses. The courts don't like dealing with the pro ses. And they do things wrong.
Yep.
And it winds up costing them more money to fix it than if it had been done right in the first place. So you're not only helping that individual person, but I think helping the whole court system to function more efficiently.
Yeah, yeah, I think that has a lot to do with why so many states and local bar associations have come out with ethics opinions, you know, giving full green lights and supporting attorneys offering unbundled legal services, you know, and ethically by the bar associations, because they can see the benefit it has on limiting the amount of folks that are making these mistakes when they go to court and when they're filing pro se, because there's so many people now doing that as a result, you know, just over the last few years, how much that's increased. So I think that has a lot to do with why so many of the courts have supported that.
Well, I think because of the availability now of forms and companies like LegalZoom, that attorneys have to expand the base that we're, the way we're offering services, or attorneys may be become utilized less and less and less. So if we want to stay a viable part of the marketplace, we've got to expand how we're doing things. We've got to respond.
Absolutely. Yep, exactly. And adapt. And adapt to the way the market has changed. You know, in 2006, I think we had maybe 30 or 40% filing pro se. Now in 2016, we're at 60 to 70% nationwide. And, you know, back in the 1970s, it was 1%. So this is a trend that has happened. This has changed. It's completely changed in the last 10 to 20 to 30 years. And so, you know, it's necessary for, you know, attorneys to adapt if they want to continue to be competitive in this market, especially like you said, with, you know, companies like LegalZoom and so forth making these forms available and walking them through it, you know, with these automated form services to continue to be competitive and provide services, you know, that is unique to an attorney. You know, that you can give them advice, you can give them guidance, you know their local court, and there's value in that. It's just a matter of finding a way to fit these services that you provide into the budget of all these clients.
Yes, and I think, you know, attorneys talk about things like LegalZoom, their practice, you know, UPL, an authorized practice of law, and a lot of these services probably are, and the best way for us to fight them is financially.
Yep, because, you know, as much as LegalZoom is a great, you know, a valuable service in certain scenarios, there isn't a substitute in many cases, especially in family law, for a competent, experienced attorney that knows that local court to draft up that paperwork, give the client guidance, be there in court when necessary as well. That is always going to be, you know, a value that no technology, no software can provide. And so it's really just a matter of attorneys like yourself, you know, offering options that makes it so that the client can make the decision to have an attorney assisting with that and not having to go it alone simply because of the cost.
Exactly. So we need to fight back by changing the way we're doing things.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly what you're doing, Kathy. So, again, we really appreciate coming on and sharing how it is that you've been working with these folks and the work you're doing for them, because it does really make a difference. And so thank you.
Oh, can I give a shout-out to Graham?
Absolutely. Please do.
He's great. So y'all need to keep him, and he gives great advice.
Well, we certainly appreciate the feedback, and you know, we've been hearing that same thing from so many of our attorneys, and we're all committed in this team for giving you guys the best advice, suggestions, ideas, education, whatever it is that can make the difference for you to be able to reach out to more clients and offer these services to folks that otherwise couldn't afford it, because that's what this is all about. So with that, thank you, Kathy, and we will go ahead and wrap up the episode. For everyone else that is listening, we certainly appreciate you participating. Again, if there's anyone else, any attorneys out there that you feel would benefit from these strategies that are being shared on this podcast, please share it with them. We also released a new webinar that is now live on our site at unbundledattorney.com, which basically condenses some of the strategies and things that we have learned from the webinar, from the podcast, excuse me, of all the main best strategies that our attorneys are offering, the themes that come across all of these interviews. So that webinar is now live on our website, but a third of the way down. So those of you that want to get a very condensed version of all these options can now see that in less than an hour in one tight webinar. So feel free to check that out, and that can help as well. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up. Thanks for everyone participating. Thank you again to Kathy, and we will see everyone on the next episode.
Thank you, Dave.
For more information about how our lead generation services can help you grow your practice, visit our website at www.unbundledattorney.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you get each new episode as soon as it's available, and leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. Once again, thanks for listening.